Geopolitics and Empire is joined by Dr. Calvin Beissner, who's founder, president, and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, a network of Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the good news of salvation by God's grace received through faith in Jesus Christ's death and resurrection. We'll be discussing a new book that he has edited and contributed to called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, that's coming out this month. Welcome to Geopolitics and Empire, Calvin.
It's great to be back with you. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you for the first time on Geopolitics and Empire. I know you were, I guess, on my TNT show, and I've been following the work of Cornwall for a long time. I have this book about a decade ago. I don't even remember when. And I've been reading the new book. It's not out yet, but it's really fantastic, and it's really gives a wide perspective for people to understand what is really happening with the climate and climate change, and climate change-ism, as I like to call it. And maybe to start, in the beginning of the book, you give a brief summary, and then there are different authors that provide articles throughout. And you say anthropogenic global warming is real, but unlikely to become catastrophic. Essentially, it's not a crisis. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I think some people who embrace the notion that global warming caused by human activity is going to be catastrophic, is going to be an existential threat, will say, well, if you don't embrace that idea, then you don't believe in global warming at all. So you wind up being called a climate denier, whatever that means. It's pretty hard to deny climate. A climate change denier. Well, it's pretty hard to deny that too, since climate changes quite regularly, like every year from winter to spring to summer to fall, and over longer cycles as well, climate changes. So it's pretty hard really to be a true climate denier or a climate change denier. And basically that denier term tends to be a sort of a pejorative. It's a personal attack, once really to compare you with Holocaust deniers, which is not exactly complimentary. But what we at the Cornwall Alliance think is that the best empirical evidence, and that's what science is really all about, is empirical evidence. It's not models. Models can be very helpful in investigation, but they don't bring you to conclusions. The best empirical evidence indicates that, yeah, human activity, especially the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas to make energy, which is a really good thing because it provides food and clothing and shelter and everything else that we need in terms of material things, but also a number of other activities that we do, agricultural activities and so on. These add to the atmosphere what often are called greenhouse gases. These are gases that absorb heat as it moves from the surface of the earth out towards space. And they send some of that heat back down toward the surface. The result is that the surface of the earth is warmer than it otherwise would be. Well, of course, you know, the earth would be solid ice if it weren't for some greenhouse effect. We have to have that. But the best empirical evidence indicates that the greenhouse gases that we've added to the atmosphere, most importantly, carbon dioxide, are probably responsible for only about 1-2% of the warming of the atmosphere that we've observed over the last 100 to 150 years, meaning around a tenth to perhaps 2/10 of a degree Celsius. That's certainly not a problem. You know, in any locale, the nighttime low to the daytime high will differ by anywhere from 10 to 30, 40, 50 degrees. And the summer high to winter low will differ by 100 degrees or more. So that's just not a catastrophe. But the benefits we get from those fossil fuels and from other activities, you know, growing plants, growing beef and pork and chicken and so on, the benefits from those are tremendous. And so we want to look carefully at a cost-benefit analysis. And when we do that, we think that the the demand to reduce our activities that contribute to global warming really flies up against the evidence that we would be better off if we didn't do that. And interestingly enough, even the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tends to agree with us on that. They may have a somewhat more alarming view of how much warming comes, but that doesn't drive them to an alarming view about human well-being. They agree that regardless what we do, we're going to be much better off a century from now than we are today.
There's, you know, I totally agree with you. There's so much in the book. And so just, you know, we're just going to cover, I want to cover a lot of this stuff. And then perhaps not as much in depth, which is why people can get the book when it comes out very soon. Right. But, you know, one of the early on, the sort of the kryptonite, one of the Achilles heels for this narrative of climate change, there's a number of them that really poke holes in their boat. And in the book, it's mentioned, quote, over the last two millennia, it was widely recognized that air temperature had varied considerably, with warm conditions during the Roman climatic optimum and the medieval warm period. And it says the problem with this picture is that the climate fluctuated naturally and without forcing by carbon dioxide, and more importantly, that air temperatures during the Roman climatic optimum and medieval warm period rivaled or exceeded those of the present without a concomitant rise in carbon dioxide. So it's like that right there just alludes to, you know, it was warmer. We didn't have this energy. And then, you know, and you have Roy Spencer in the book talking about the sun. It's like basically the sun is the radiative energy source for Earth's climate system, driving weather processes and thereby the climate state over time. And for me, it's like that. And I've talked to Piers Corbin, the astrophysicist, and I've actually purchased his weather action reports a decade ago. I taught a course called Environment and International Relations here. And I actually used his weather action report. Piers bases his predictions on the solar and lunar cycle, and he actually gets it right. To the day, like my mind was boggled when he accurately predicted the weather. And so your further thoughts on the medieval warm period and what would be like and the sun as a factor.
Yes, that really is a crucial matter, because the catastrophist narrative wants to say that what we're experiencing now is unprecedented in human history anyway. And yet we have very clear data that the Minoan warm period around 200 BC, then the Roman warm period around 200 AD, and then the medieval warm period, roughly 900 to 1200 AD, those periods were warmer than the present, and much warmer than any of those was what's called the Holocene climate optimum, which ran roughly about 8,000 to 4,000 BC. That's a much warmer period. All of those happened without any increase in the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere. As a matter of fact, it was falling throughout those periods. Until just about 200 years ago, it was falling. Now, that's not to say that carbon dioxide added to the atmosphere doesn't make it warmer than it otherwise would be, right? That's basic physics, because CO2 is an infrared absorbing gas. It absorbs some heat as it moves out from the Earth. It re-radiates that heat. Some of it goes on out to space. Some of it comes back down to the surface. That's basic physics. But, you know, basic physics also tells us that if you drop a rock and a feather at the same moment from the same height, they'll hit the ground at the same moment. Unless, of course, they're in air, in which case the rock plummets and the feather kind of wafts back and forth, and you know, it might blow up and get stuck in a tree and not come down for years, right? Reality is a lot more complicated than basic physics. So the key importance of the medieval warm period, the Roman warm period, the Minoan warm period, and the Holocene climate optimum is that they demonstrate that we do not know whether carbon dioxide was a bit player or perhaps half the cause of the last 100 years or so of warming, or maybe the majority cause. We just don't know. We can't know because we can't rule out other causes, especially causes related to the sun. We have an entire chapter on the role of the sun. That chapter is by Michael Connolly, who's an independent scientist based in Ireland, with his PhD in spectroscopy, which, you know, some people might think, well, how relevant is that? Well, that's where you examine how light and infrared pass through various gases. That's how you're going to understand the heat trapping or heat retaining properties of so-called greenhouse gases. His son, Ronan Connolly, another independent scientist in Ireland, has been specializing in climate change since about 2008. And most importantly, in that chapter, we have Dr. Willie Soon, who is a former researcher with the Solar, Stellar, and Planetary Sciences Division of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and probably the world's leading authority on how the sun affects climate. They argue in their chapter in our book that, yeah, the sun is undoubtedly a very important contributor to the cycles of warming and cooling, and it certainly can't be ruled out in terms of the current warming.
And, you know, there are so many other topics here. You know, another is are the clouds and the oceans, right, and urbanization. And so just, you know, briefly, if you could just comment on, from as I see it, it seems like the sun is the big one, and then you've got other smaller effects like the clouds and then the oceans, and then even urbanization. Just the thoughts on those.
Yeah, right. Well, where to start with the ones that you just mentioned? Let me pick up first urbanization, because actually we don't talk a lot about urbanization in this book. The late Patrick Michaels, in his chapter on models, on climate models, does address that some, and frankly, I wish that we had done it some more. The reason for that is that increasing studies are showing that the data that we have on temperature around the globe are heavily skewed toward urban areas and away from rural areas, uninhabited areas. Why that's important is that urban areas generate their own heat or also absorb more heat from the sun. So blacktopped roads absorb more heat, which is why your feet hurt when you go out on blacktop on a hot day, right? And they don't hurt when you're walking on grass or dirt, right? So urban areas are naturally warmer, or we might say anthropogenically warmer, than suburban and much warmer than rural areas. The best studies on this now are indicating that probably something in the nature of 40 to 50% of the apparent increase in global average temperature over the last 120, 140 years has actually been only happening in the urban areas. And so our entire notion of how much have we warmed over the last 140 years or so needs to be brought down from about 1 to 1.1 degrees Celsius to about half a degree Celsius instead. That also means that future warming from added carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide is going to be less than what people had thought when they assumed that all the warming was driven by carbon dioxide, especially. So that's one part of what you raised. You also asked about the role of clouds, and we do have an entire chapter on that by Dr. Spencer. He's one of the world's leading authorities on that. He's a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and he does work under NASA and under the government, the state government of Alabama, on climate change. And his work, along with that of say, for instance, Dr. Dick Lindzen, Richard Lindzen, emeritus professor of meteorology and atmospheric physics at MIT, they have shown that whereas almost all of the computer climate models of how the climate responds to greenhouse gases assume that if you warm surface temperature some, clouds will respond in a way that will enhance, increase that warming. Instead, what they've found from actual observation is that when you warm the surface a bit, low-lying clouds, which cool the surface, increase, and very high stratospheric clouds, which warm the surface, decrease, and vice versa. And so, in other words, the models have it exactly backward. Well, pretty much the entire case for dangerous, potentially catastrophic, existential threat, global warming from CO2 and other greenhouse gases, pretty much the entire case depends on the assumption that the way clouds and other parts of the climate system respond to a little bit of warming is to increase that warming. In other words, positive feedbacks. What Spencer's and Lindzen's work shows, and Spencer discusses in depth in our book, is that the opposite is true. The feedbacks are net negative. They reduce the warming. So that's a part of it. We have a chapter on the role of the oceans by Anthony Lupo. He's professor of atmospheric sciences and oceanography, rather, at the University of Missouri. And he does research in large-scale atmospheric dynamics and climate dynamics and tropical meteorology and the like. His chapter on the oceans explains how various ocean cycles, ocean current cycles, the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, the Pacific Oscillation, El Nino and La Nina, things of this sort, right? He explains how those contribute to long-term changes in global average temperature. That's especially important because the news media, for example, tend to really focus heavily on hottest years, right? Anytime we've got a summer where things just get exceptionally hot, the news media will say, well, this is the hottest year on record. Well, you know, our records in terms of comparable data don't actually go back all that far. The best we have is satellite data, and that only goes back to 1979. But what they tend to downplay is the fact that those hottest years are also El Nino years. And El Nino years are years in which, because of the El Nino, La Nina, Southern Oscillation in the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Ocean releases a great deal of heat that it has stored into the atmosphere. And that's what gets us the extra warm years during that time. And by the way, when I say extra warm, we're talking about temperature differences measured in tenths of a degree Celsius. We're not talking, you know, the difference between, say, 59 degree average temperature for the Earth and 79 degrees or something like that, right? And so all of this, again, contributes to the case that yes, human activity emitting greenhouse gases does make the atmosphere warmer than it otherwise would be, but it's not making catastrophe. It's not causing great harm to humanity. One of the easiest ways we can recognize that is very, very simple. Over the last 100 years, the rate of human mortality caused by extreme weather events has dropped by more than 98%. And that's because of all the benefits that we get from the activities that contribute a little bit to warming. If you think about all the benefits we get from transportation fuels, from electricity, to light our houses, to run our refrigerators, to run our factories, and so on, If you think about all those benefits and the benefits of food from agriculture that also requires activities that emit greenhouse gases, hey, those benefits far outweigh any risks from changes in climate, changes in extreme weather events.
And you know, something you discuss in your book, first of all, what you mentioned about their models, they always seem to be the opposite of what's true, the inverse.
Right.
And that life would be better as a result of a warming globe. And, you know, I've lived in Mongolia, which has the coldest capital on Earth, Ulaanbaatar. I've spent a couple of years in Kazakhstan, northern Kazakhstan. It's absolutely freezing. Those people live and die by coal, natural gas, you know, you name it. And so, but I think there is this sense, they say that if there, even if there was more CO2, that would help the plants grow, that we would have a more lush environment.
That's true too.
So any thoughts on life being actually better if the world was slightly warmer? And as you're referring to, even if we are warming, it's minuscule. I don't think the ice is going to melt. And by the way, you know, it is strange that we see the Obamas and the Bill Gateses and the Al Gores purchasing mansions on beaches all over the place. Yeah. And so they're not actually walking the walk. Further thoughts there.
Right. Well, you know, why don't we start with the simple fact that we do know that the world warms and cools in long-term cycles. And we've had much, much colder cycles than the present, and significantly warmer cycles than the present. We're actually, in terms of cycles, we're due for some very significant cooling over the next few hundred years to perhaps a few thousand years. I used to live in South Florida. I was 15 miles from the beach, so it wasn't a beach house, right? But I was only 8 feet above sea level. And at the time, of course, the UN IPCC was putting out data on how much the melt of ice in Greenland and Antarctica was contributing to sea level rise. And again, you can't blame the IPCC for this because its data, its figures were quite moderate. They didn't call for any rapid increase in the rate of sea level rise. But politicians, environmental activist organizations, and the news media trumpeted this. And Al Gore, of course, was saying that, oh boy, by the end of this century, or maybe even by 2050, most of Florida would be underwater. So I took the IPCC's own figures on the rate of sea level rise. And I asked, okay, at this rate, when will I have beachfront property so that my house is worth a whole lot more than it is now? The answer was about 3,600 years. Now, nobody, no climate scientist thinks that we're not going to have a natural cooling period sometime between now and 3,600 years from now. So that's just not a significant problem. You know, I'm sorry, I've actually lost track of part of your question. So why don't you bring me back to it?
Yeah, it was because you answered some of my other questions about the cooling cycle, because you also wrote in your book, it won't necessarily be moderated, this warming, prevented or even reversed by a new natural cycle of global cooling. And, you know, I've had people on discuss that. You sort of answered that. So there are people saying that we will be going into cooling in the future. Yeah. And it's interesting when they say we have these heat records, summer heat records, but they never mention cold records that we see all over the place every year. Any further thought on the threat of us going into a cooling phase?
Yeah. First, of course, the cold records just don't make the news because that doesn't fit the narrative. I think there is a very plausible case to be made for the notion that we will see significant global cooling over the next 2 to 5 decades because of a cycle in the sun, the solar energy output and solar magnetic wind output cycle up and down together. And together, they affect temperature here on Earth. The solar energy output directly affects it because solar energy is our source of heat, right? So as that rises and falls, it contributes a bit to warming and cooling. Not an enormous amount, but a bit. But very important, too, is that solar magnetic wind moderates the influx of galactic cosmic rays. Now, why are those important? Because as they pass through the atmosphere, they interact with molecules in a way that forms cloud nuclei for low-level clouds. So in other words, the more galactic cosmic rays we have coming into the atmosphere, the more low-level clouds we'll have. Well, low-level clouds cool the surface of the Earth. So since solar magnetic wind blocks galactic cosmic rays, more solar magnetic wind means cooler temperatures on Earth. Well, solar magnetic wind and solar energy output cycle together. So you put those two things together, and there's a very plausible case to be made. And of course, we'll only know as we see the future, right? But there's a very plausible case for the idea that we're going to see some significant cooling over the next 20 to 40 or 50 years. That is discussed somewhat in one of our other chapters in the book. We have a chapter by Nicola Scafetta. He's written on, which was his chapter? gotta come to this here.
I've got it as well. Let's see, Nicholas. Chapter 9, Holy Grail of Climate Change, Quantifying Climate Sensitivity.
Right, yes, thank you. It's, you know, we got too many chapters in here for me to keep track of, even though I edited the book. But Scafetta is a professor of atmospheric physics and oceanography at the University of Naples in Italy. And he teaches on meteorology, climatology, and oceanography. And he is one of the world's leading experts specifically on how solar energy and magnetic wind input to the Earth's climate system affects climate. And so he has addressed that in his chapter, and I think he's made a very good case that probably the sun, and his chapter, of course, is here in agreement with the chapter by Connolly, and Soon, that the sun probably plays at least a very prominent role, if not the dominant role, in even the cycles of global temperature, not just the overall temperature of the Earth.
And this, I guess this goes to the question before that, wouldn't a slightly warmer world be better for humanity, especially facing the opposite threat of a colder world? Yeah. I personally don't see any problem. I'm here in Mexico where it's pretty warm all year. And I just feel like I don't see any problem with a slightly warmer world. Do you?
No, I don't. You know, we can look at retirement move patterns. Where do people tend to retire? Do they go from Florida to Minnesota or Canada, or do they go from Canada or Minnesota to Florida? It's pretty obvious where they go. And they're doing that because warmth is better for human health than cold. In fact, heat waves tend to kill only about 1/20th as many people per day as cold snaps. So just simply the reduction in the frequency and intensity of cold snaps would mean a net benefit, a very large net benefit to human health. Now, also, warming driven by greenhouse gases, pretty much all of the scientists agree on this, happens mostly toward the poles, mostly in winter, and mostly at night. It doesn't happen so much toward the equator in summer, in the daytime. There are a variety of different reasons why that is so. But the consequence of that is that rather than raising temperatures where they're already high toward the equator, we're raising temperatures where they're low. That results in lengthened growing seasons for agriculture, and it also results in fewer mortality-causing cold snaps. So those are very good things. And then finally, we would be crazy if we didn't pay attention to what's the other impact of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It doesn't just contribute to warming of the atmosphere. It's also used by all plants. And the more of it they get, the better they grow. On average, for every doubling of carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere in which plants are growing, you get about a 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. Plants grow better in warmer and colder weather. They grow better in wetter and drier soils. They resist diseases and pests better. They make better use of soil nutrients. And all of that means more plant matter, including grain crops, fruit crops, and so on that we human beings depend on, right? More plant matter for everything that eats plants. And everything that eats something else that does eat plants. And if we ask ourselves, now, who benefits the most from that? It's the world's poor who have the toughest time affording enough food, right? And so added CO2 in the atmosphere is a tremendous benefit to everything living on Earth. The whole notion that climate change, here's another claim of the catastrophist narrative. Anthropogenic climate change is driving the sixth great extinction. Right? We're going to see thousands and thousands, maybe millions of species driven extinct by global warming. Now, there is zero empirical evidence behind that. It's all a matter of computer modeling, and modeling that, frankly, is based on crazy assumptions. But that's the claim. The opposite is what we ought actually to expect. With the increased growth of plants, and with their being able to expand their ranges, because remember, they grow better in warmer and cooler temperatures and in wetter and drier soils, right? That means they're going to spread to warmer and cooler places, wetter and drier places. So all plants are going to increase their range, which, by the way, we have shown from satellite imagery that shows that we have had a very large increase in plant in leaf index or leaf coverage of the surface of the earth over the last 40 or 50 years, and it is continuing, and it is almost entirely due to increasing CO2 in the atmosphere. This is good. Well, what that means is that all the different animals and other things that depend on plants can increase their ranges too, just as the plants increase theirs. So if you care about species extinction, you should welcome some global warming rather than protesting it.
Yeah, you just made me think, you know, one of the reasons I very much enjoy living here in Mexico is I can wear shorts and a t-shirt literally all year round. I don't need heating really. Or cooling. I am using it now a little bit, but we don't expound as much energy as we living in a place like Mexico versus like when I was living in Mongolia or Kazakhstan. And just a few things that you mentioned, you know, warmer climates giving, you know, providing more food. You know, I know people here in Mexico, they've got some, you know, weekend home outside of the city, and they've got like fruit trees, avocados, mangoes, and they just get so many avocados, they don't know what to do with them. They're just giving them away for free. And it's like, isn't that wonderful that you could have just an abundance of food in such a warmer climate? And, you know, I don't even think, for me, winter doesn't exist in Mexico, but, you know, just this past winter, you know, a handful of people, Mexicans passed away because of the cold snap, as you mentioned, or even in Mongolia. Like, I've come across people who, you know, there's a drinking problem in Mongolia. They call it the Soviet hangover, a lot of vodka drinking, and you'll see people passed out in wintertime on the street. Sometimes they'll freeze to death. They'll literally, you know, freeze to death and die. And you don't have as much of a problem, like, as you mentioned. And, you know, I'm just giving my personal experience. My experience confirms what you're saying. And I do then want to move to, and this is for me the juicier part about, you know, who is doing this? Why are they doing it? In your book, you talk about, you know, energy, of course. You say the transition, you know, this transition to renewables and away from hydrocarbons. I don't like the term fossil fuels because I don't think, I'm more of the abiotic view, because I think that's also a more biblical perspective, that I don't think oil comes from fossils. I think it's comes from the ground.
Coal and probably does, but not likely oil and natural gas. I think there's a good case to be made for the abiotic developed in the mantle of the earth theory about natural gas and coal and oil, rather.
Yeah, maybe we can get into that if we have time. And you say that the transition would slow, stop, or reverse the conquest of poverty and the high rates of disease and premature death that invariably accompany it for billions of people around the world. Yeah. I've been lately calling this, so these policies that they want to implement, energy and everything else, neo-feudalism. Instead of net zero, I call it death zero. And I'm not making any more bones about it. And so your further thoughts on
absolutely
what they're trying to do, the solar, the winds. I, over the weekend, literally, the governor of my state here in Jalisco, Mexico, Enrique Alfaro, a friend of mine, sent this clip to me. He was at a press conference. Last year was the first year here in Mexico we had to do the vehicle emissions test, pay it, and take the test. And if you don't take it, you get into trouble. You know, up until now, Mexico was really not doing that. And the governor said, he literally said that this is a global program that all countries have to abide by. And he said that the vehicle emissions test. And he said that, you know, using your car creates emissions. So we have to decrease your emission use, which means disincentivizing you to use your car. And I actually had a friend of mine who her car didn't pass the test here. So now her car has been taken away. It's like she's not technically not supposed to drive it. And that impoverishes her because now she takes hours more to use the Byzantine public transport or pay taxis, which costs more. She can't go to church as easily without the car. She can't go to work or see friends. And it's just, this is like neo-feudalism. Your further thoughts on these policies.
Yeah, neo-feudalism is one great term for it. Neo-colonialism is another one that my dear friend Vijay Jayaraj, who's the author of our last chapter in the book, Climate and Energy Policy in the Developing World, he just argues that what we have here is the wealthy West saying to the rest, we got wealthy by using coal, oil, and natural gas like there was no tomorrow. You don't get to do that. You have to stay poor. You have to continue to use wood and dried dung and other biofuels as your primary heating and cooking fuels. And you have to basically do without modern transportation, do without significant electricity availability. This is, I think, just absolutely condemnable. It is morally reprehensible what the West is asking the rest to do, or practically demanding that they do. I think what we need to do is to recognize that the benefits derived from abundant, affordable, reliable, scalable energy, especially in the form of electricity for homes and businesses and the like, and especially in the way of transport fuels for cars, trucks, planes, and the like. The benefits from these things so far outweigh, thousands of times outweigh, the harms that come from them that it's just simply scandalous that wealthy Western environmentalists are telling the world, we have to back away from these. You know, could the United States, could Western European countries, highly developed countries already, could they transition significantly from hydrocarbon fuels to wind and solar? Yes, at extremely high cost, and with great reductions in the reliability of our electrical grids, and there would be price to pay in terms of human mortality because of that. But we could do that if there seemed to be a really good reason for it. There isn't, right? But countries in sub-Saharan Africa, places like India, Southeast Asia, and the like, Mongolia would be a good example. The stans, the former Soviet republics of the Islamic world, they would be devastated if prohibited from using coal, oil, and natural gas. And this is why their leaders are more and more just saying to the World Economic Forum, to the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the Framework Convention on Climate Change, no, we're not doing this. China, of course, is the best example of that. And, you know, they have some other political agendas in mind here as well. I think they are playing the West like a violin. Their aim is to get us to reduce our energy use, which reduces our prosperity, which reduces our ability to afford competition with them, whether economic or military. This is all part of their aim to fulfill Mao's 100-year marathon dream, that in 100 years from the 1949 victory in the Communist Revolution in China to 2049, China would surpass the United States and become the world's number one superpower. They are playing us like a violin, taking control of the sources of lithium and cobalt and so on, and taking control of the production of wind turbines, solar panels, all of that sort of thing, and then selling these things to the West. We might as well have a suicide impulse to be going along with that.
That's how I've described this policy in the West. It's total civilizational suicide. And you mentioned control. You know, just to go further, I mean, not only is it neo-feudalism or neo-colonialism, it's totalitarianism. I mean, yes. And it's a religion, because it's a green religion. I've got a friend of mine who's convinced that the Green Rider in the book of Revelation refers to this green movement now. And I just read last week, the ECB, European Central Bank, so the EU, they're basically saying, if you're not down with the green values, with this green ideology or green religion, you cannot work here. You know, it's like, it's reminiscent of you can't buy or sell, like what we went through under from 2020 onward. Even here in Mexico, there were places you could not enter in some states to the supermarket to buy food. Some people could not be employed anymore. Like, literally, you can't buy or sell. It's totalitarian. And then even the banks here in Mexico now, we're seeing this all around the world, where they've updated the app, and now it has like a carbon tracking system, carbon social credit score. And so, you know, we're already seeing you can't work here if you don't believe in these green values. We're tracking your individual daily energy use. I've got friends that work in corporations in Mexico. They say they're having green audits now. They're checking to see how many, you know, LGBT people you've hired, how much energy you're using. Any further thoughts? And they also, you know, we've seen on mainstream news every week now, we're seeing they're saying don't have children. Those are climate crimes. Yeah. So, you know, it's again, Malthusian ideology, depopulation, and total control. Any further thoughts on some of these ideas that they're putting out there?
Well, we could go for another couple of hours unpacking what you've just gotten into. So much of this is rooted, I mean, you mentioned, for instance, advising people not to have children, and counting children toward your carbon footprint, right? So much of this is all rooted in the old Malthusian and then the neo-Malthusian worldview that sees human beings as a burden on the earth, rather than as made in the image of God to be productive and to be good stewards of the earth. And this is a major element of the message of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Because we are made in God's image, we are given the task of representing God on the earth to all the rest of life on the earth. And so when God tells us in Genesis 1:28 to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over it, we need to look at that in its context. Why is it that God would want us to do this? Is it because he wants us to just go out and totally abuse and exploit the earth, to rape and pillage the earth, so to speak? Certainly not. We need to learn what it means for us to exercise a proper subduing and ruling of the earth by looking at what God has done, because after all, we're made in his image. So what do we learn from the previous 27 verses of Genesis? Well, God in the beginning made the heavens and the earth, and at first the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And then we get the rest of the story of creation. What does he do? He brings everything out of nothing. He brings light out of darkness. He brings order out of chaos. He brings life out of non-life. He brings great abundance and variety of life on the earth. So what should our function look like? What should our stewarding of his creation look like? It should be likewise. We should be increasing light, which the Bible uses consistently as a metaphor for truth, understanding, knowledge, right? We should be increasing light. We should be increasing order, bringing more and more order, order out of less and less order. We should be bringing more and more life out of less and less life. We should be preserving and even enhancing the varieties of life. There are hundreds of varieties of various different domestic animals now that didn't exist as recently as a few centuries ago because of our breeding. There are varieties of all sorts of plants that we've brought about because of crossbreeding and now genetic engineering. All of these things are ways in which we reflect the image of God. So here at the Cornwall Alliance, what we say is that our calling is to enhance the fruitfulness and the beauty and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors. When we do those two things, we're really fulfilling the two great commandments, to love God and to love neighbor.
Yeah, you know, for you, for me, you just eloquently explained what I have always instinctively understood after having read the Bible, you know, going through it the first time. It's you know, that was my instinct. You've just explained it, fleshed it out. And, you know, something else the Bible alludes to and what I want to ask you about as to what this, you know, furthermore, what this really is about, this climate changeism, as I call it. You know, in the book, again, you guys touch on it, the history, you go into depth, the history and the politics of the climate change movement, right? That it's a well-funded and orchestrated eco-socialist campaign to transform global society through wealth distribution. You mentioned the World Economic Forum, Great Reset. We talk about that a lot, yeah, on this podcast. And for me, it seems like it really, really also boils down to world governments. You talk about, yes, Maurice Strong and how he believed the UN must be transformed into a world government. Just this week, I was reading from Democracy Without Borders, which is the organization that's pushing for world government. I've interviewed one of the founders on this show, Andreas Bummel, and I read his book about how they're trying to reform the UN to create a UN parliamentary assembly and create a proper world government with force. And in this recent article they wrote, they said basically that climate change would be a great pretext to be used to construct a world, absolutely, government. And they, yeah, say public health, like pandemic, could also, which, or the threat of nuclear war, even Oppenheimer, they had the Oppenheimer film that came out last year. Articles came out how Oppenheimer and others were saying that this threat the threat of nuclear war could be used as the pretext to construct a world government. And it just seems to me like this is one of the main things they're driving for. Some of your thoughts here.
Well, I think that's very, very clear. And Dr. David LeGates, who is a recently retired professor of climatology at the University of Delaware, he's now our director of research and education, addresses that at considerable length in his chapter, The History and Politics of Climate Change, in our book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. David makes a very, very strong case that the politics behind this are all dedicated to the destruction of national sovereignty and the replacement of it with basically a one-world government. Now, you know, if you've ever been frustrated with how difficult it is to get, say, your city council to take seriously a problem that you have, imagine how difficult it would be to get somebody in a global parliament to take seriously a problem that you have. You know, every time you go from more local to less local to, you know, larger and larger scope of government, you reduce the dependence of those in that government on the consent of the governed. Now, I happen to believe that one of the keys that made America such a successful place was its commitment to the principle that government is supposed to rule by the consent of the governed. Well, you know, one of the ways that we exercise consent is by voting, right? And so we elect people to office to represent us because we can't all be involved in all decisions, right? But another way that we vote, another way that we exercise consent, either giving it or withholding it, is by where we choose to live, right? And so one of the ways of describing American politics has been that America is a set of experiments, political experiments. Every state is its own experiment. Every city is its own experiment. And as states and cities try on various different policies, people are attracted to them or they're repelled from them. And so you have changes in population, changes in where people choose to live. If you eliminate all borders, if you eliminate national sovereignty, if you have just one world government, that means of exercising consent disappears. You know, if I don't like the policies of Pennsylvania, I can move to Florida or vice versa. But there is no planet B. If I don't like the policies of the global government, I can't move to Mars, even despite Elon Musk's highest ambitions, right? So I think it's very important that we recognize the globalizing tendency of the climate catastrophist narrative and the politics that go with it, and that we stand against that. And when we do that, we're really fighting for freedom. We're fighting for justice, truly, because justice requires that people get what they deserve, not what they don't deserve. And that's not going to be served well at a global level by a global government. If you doubt that, just ask the people who live within the European Union, who have watched the European Parliament go from barely any power to exercising enormous power over the lives of people who have no say about who occupies seats in that parliament. No, we don't want to go that direction. We want to emphasize the importance of localism. We want to devolve power from wider jurisdictions to narrower jurisdictions in order to defend and restore government by consent of the governed.
You mentioned the EU. I'm also an EU citizen, and I recently interviewed one of my former professors who I'm trying to find the exact quote, but he's been saying, he's a former UN independent expert, senior lawyer at the UN, and he himself is saying that the EU is now a scam. It's a dystopia. NATO is a criminal organization. They're restricting the freedom, the rights of millions of Europeans, the EU. So we've got someone at the top, you know, saying this is what has happened. And, you know, the emperor has no clothes. This week was a milestone for me. It was the first time my child read a book to me, and it was exciting. And it, I think
that
also
is exciting, isn't it?
It's and it's very symbolic in many ways, because the book that she happened to read to me that we had, it was the Emperor Has No Clothes, and it's
that's great.
And so it's like, you know, what is to be done? The UN Emperor and our national governments that are going along have no clothes, and we're forced to go along and sort of pretend. And I would assume you're optimistic like I am in a way. People say I'm black-pilled. From a secular material worldview, I am sort of black-pilled or even cyanide-pilled, because I see things progressively getting worse. As you know, I feel like the Bible says things are just going to keep getting worse until Gandalf comes down the hill, right? Jesus, and that's my white pill. So because of that, I always have a optimistic worldview in the end, metaphysically speaking, but worldly speaking, not so much. You know, what are your thoughts on what can be done? What can we do? And, you know, are you optimistic for the future?
I am optimistic for the future, truly. And I am not because of newspaper headlines. I'm optimistic for the future because I believe that the Bible tells us that faith in Jesus Christ is going to continue to spread around the world, and that will bring more and more people to living in a way that is mutually respectful, that seeks to love our neighbors and to do to others as we would have them do to us, to live in obedience to the Ten Commandments. You know, you shall have no other gods before me, not take the Lord's name in vain, and treat him as irrelevant or unimportant, not to worship idols, including the idols of wealth and health and power and sex and anything else, not to honor the Sabbath, to have a day of rest, and this pattern of the importance of a day of rest every week. That's not something that any other religion than Judaism and Christianity has taught, but this is important to human beings. Work is of our nature because we are created in God's image and he's a worker, but so is rest. And then we have, you know, honor your father and mother, the first commandment with a promise that it may go well with you when on the earth. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery or any other form of sexual unfaithfulness. You shall not steal. You shall not lie, bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet. You know, if we would all, we could get rid of pretty much the entire federal registry in the United States and all the law codes if we would just all abide by the Ten Commandments. You know, as the Christian faith continues to spread, more and more people will begin to live consistently with this. And I used to be a professor of church history. The current rate of growth of the Christian faith around the world is more rapid than at any other time in history. And that's really exciting. You know, are we seeing contraction in the what we used to call Christendom, basically Western Europe and some of Eastern Europe and North America, other countries heavily influenced previously by the Christians? Yeah, we're seeing some contraction, and yet that has come and gone over the centuries. But we're seeing rapidity of growth in the global South, unlike anything in the history of the church. You know, Jesus Christ told us that the very gates of hell would not prevail against his church. Now, that doesn't depict hell swinging its gates at us to try to knock us down. Gates are meant to keep somebody out, right? The picture is of the church assaulting the gates of hell. And he says those gates will not prevail against his church. So I believe that the Christian faith is going to continue to spread and continue to grow around the world, and that will bring about more justice, more liberty, more peace, and more prosperity. I don't get that from the news. I get that from Scripture.
I had a couple years back, I guess, on the podcast, people can check the archive, Robert Woodbury, I think is his name, and he did a study, a paper, on how in Africa, where there was a higher presence of evangelical or more Protestant-like Christianity, there was higher levels of democracy and higher economic development, which is quite fascinating and kind of, I think, speaking to you, what you're saying. And then, you know, there's more in your book. You know, any final thought? Something interesting that you guys talk about is the narrative control, how science has become anti-science, this cult, yeah, the state-sponsored cult, sort of. And so they control the narrative, the school academy. And not, you know, this talk of denialism, it's almost like the Middle Ages again in the Inquisition. I was reading yesterday, one YouTuber was saying how Google has a new policy on the new denial. So it's like burn him at the stake, but I guess digitally speaking today. Sure. And so, you know, any final thoughts for us? Do you think this climate change program eventually collapses, you know, and any final thought for us?
Well, I do think, you know, I just thought back to the book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, that came out in the late 1950s. And, you know, it's easy to be pessimistic about the extent to which an orthodoxy now controls the narrative about climate change. But if you look back through the history of science, what you see is that over and over again, dominant paradigms have collapsed. And they don't collapse typically because of a slow accretion of evidence that bit by bit persuades this person or that person. Instead, they collapse because all at once, a whole bunch of evidence comes in that cannot be reconciled with the paradigm. And the whole thing falls apart at once, all right? So I think that that is going to happen with the catastrophic anthropogenic climate change narrative. I don't think it's going to happen with the sensible narrative of benign, partially anthropogenic climate change. That makes perfect sense, right? So I do think that we can look forward to that. I do think that it is slowed by the control of so much peer-reviewed publishing by the catastrophists. It's very difficult to get published in major peer-reviewed journals if you challenge catastrophic man-made global warming today, right? But I think it's going to become increasingly easy to do that as the narrative falls apart. So I have some optimism there as well. If I may, I'd like to just point out that this book, and it's, by the way, it's almost 500 pages long. So this is substantial. I mean, you've been reading it yourself. But the Cornwall Alliance is going to offer, as long as our supply lasts, a free copy of this book to everyone who donates to us during the month of April. The printed copies of the book are due out March 19, so we'll start this offer with April 1st, and 100% of the donation will be tax deductible, because we're not offering this for sale or anything like that. It's just our way of saying thank you when people make a donation of literally any size. So they can do that by going to cornwallalliance.org/donate, or just cornwallalliance.org and look for the donation button. This is a book that people will want to put into the hands of public school science teachers, of school principals, of members of their city councils, their county boards of supervisors, and their state legislatures, because this is going to provide the kind of information, ammunition really, that is needed to get people well-informed so that they can be confident that they're doing the right thing when they stand against the kinds of policies that would, as we discussed earlier, impoverish people, slow, stop, or reverse the climb out of poverty in developing countries, and really do no good for the Earth's environment, its natural environment, but great harm to humanity.
Well, I thought this, I've come away now with a bit more optimism after this talk, and I hope listeners do as well. Again, the book Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, cornwallalliance.org. All of the links are in the description. Again, as was mentioned, if you donate during the month of April, you get the book for free. Thank you for being on Geopolitics and Empire, Dr. Calvin Beisner.
Well, thank you very much. It's a privilege. Glad to be back with you again.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes, Facebook restricts our page, Reddit and Twitter take down posts, and after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our Pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.